Hello, Philip.
Hi, Rachel. How are you doing?
I'm okay. I still have my post-viral cough, but apart from that, generally fine. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. Nursing whatever cold still lingers, but we've got half term coming up next week, so every minute up until then is a gift. Obviously, that's not true.
It is
Sorry,
a little
you go
bit
on.
true. Well, normally we each have a most Jewish thing of the week to share, but on this occasion, we've literally shared them because we had the same one.
We did, not by coincidence, but there was an event that we were both invited to, and we went along representing ourselves and you talking to me.
So you might have seen it mentioned in the press or heard it on the radio or even on social media, but Marcel Noble decided to create an amazing art installation at JW3 where he turned the entrance way from the street into the building into a Lovelock bridge. And if you don't know what a Lovelock bridge is, it's all around the world. They've got in different countries bridges where people normally go with their partner and they've inscribed a padlock which they attach to the bridge. And it's a way of like signifying their commitment to being together forever. But this one was to remember the hostages in Gaza. And you could either just sign it or you could dedicate it to an individual person. They had one up for each of the people. And there was a ceremony, and different Jewish personalities spoke and shared their thoughts. And it was actually incredibly moving.
It really was. It was so nice to be part of something that felt like we were bringing together a group of people with a shared experience to send a message out to the world, and just a chance to say to people, don't forget the hostages. There's a lot of stuff in the media at the moment about Israel, about Gaza, about anti-Semitism in the UK or around the world, and actually it often feels that the memory of the hostages is being drowned in a lot of that noise. So it was really important to be part of an event like that. Some of the speakers and the dignitaries that were there were, people from Dame Maureen Lipman to Howard Jacobson to Josh Howie, a former guest on our show. But for me, the most moving encounter I had was with Sharon Lipschitz, who was the daughter of one of the hostages, and just hearing her strength and her fortitude at this time was really very moving for me.
Yeah, she read out a list of the people from her kibbutz who were still hostages. And after she said like her father's name, and then every time she said another man's name, she said also my father. And every time she said like a young man's name, she said also my brother. And every time it was always name, also my mother. And it was really emotional because I think this whole situation has made Jews feel very connected to each other and like we are family. It doesn't really matter in a way what your politics are, but unfortunately the state of the world is bringing us all together. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we decided to relaunch the series now is because people do want to be connecting and you get to hear about the lives of different Jews.
And also, we aren't a hugely political show, which means sometimes people just want to hear Jews talk about being Jewish, what it means to them culturally, socially, without it having to immediately descend into an argument about who believes what politically and geopolitically. So that's really important to us. There were some amusing parts of the experience as well, which I guess lightened the mood quite nicely. For me, I think there's that bit where you do the photo call. So I wouldn't consider myself in any way a celebrity, but I guess by doing this show, we've been given a platform, and it's really nice we were able to represent by being there. But when they had the photo call that had a lot of the dignitaries and invited guests in, I did the right thing and let other people move forward. So if they were slightly shorter than me, or if I felt they were perhaps more significant to the cause than me, whether it was one of the more famous dignitaries that was going to get more media attention, or someone like Sharon who needed to be visibly there at the front. So I found myself edging further and further to the back of the photo call. And actually, if you look in any of the media online where the main photo has been published, you can just make my head poking up. And I didn't want to make a big deal of it. I was holding up my padlock so you could still see the important part of why we were there. It was just a moment of humor for me that I was there going, hello, hello, when really we were not the story. I guess at times that you do just need some kind of light-hearted moment.
My funny moment actually was when they did the individual photo calls for you to come and clip your padlock to the bridge. And I was so anxious because I was 100% convinced I was going to either drop the key through the slats of the bridge and it would just like plop down to the floor below, or I was going to not attach it properly and then the padlock would drop off and everyone would be tutting. You'd roll your eyes and be like, oh, typical. And I'd have had to then have sent somebody to go and get it, and it would have been a whole faff. I was really, really worried. So I managed to get it on first try. Very impressive. But then I was so relieved that I'd done it that I forgot to then turn and look at the cameras or do any of the stuff I was meant to do for them to do the proper photo. And I just like, because I was like, yay, I haven't ruined this. But also, I did have a Jude talking to me moment on Sunday.
What was that?
Well, from 2:30, the Lovelock Bridge then became open to the public and anyone could come and put their padlocks on it. And I met this lovely lady, a non-Jewish lady who'd come up from Sussex because she wanted to show her solidarity and support. I ended up chatting to her with my friend Claire in the cafe for a while. She was telling us all about how isolating it can feel to be a non-Jewish supporter of Israel and of us as Jews. So she felt compelled to come and join in. And all the while, she was eating a bagel.
Bagel.
And Claire said to her, "Are you enjoying your bagel?" And I said, "Bagel." And she said, "What do you mean?" So I explained to her the whole thing about bagel versus bagel. Well, she said that she would go with my expression because she felt I was more authentic. So I gave her one of our team bagel badges and she put it next to all her other allyship badges that she had on. So now there's a woman supporting Jewish people in a church in Sussex wearing a team bagel badge.
Excellent. Or there's a woman in a church in Sussex telling her fellow congregants how intrusive Jews are in North London.
Well, talking about intrusive Jews, what a great link. Why don't we have a quick chat about this week's episode?
This is possibly one of my most favourite episodes in terms of just, we always tell our guests that there's no real script to this. We've got questions we want to ask, but if we end up going off on a tangent, it's really not a problem. That's the joy of a conversation like this. Dan took us at our word and ran with it. I would say within a minute of the episode starting, he had hupped the entire conversation and didn't let it go until the very end. And when I say that, I literally mean the very end. Regular listeners will know the point I'm talking about when we get to it. It was a lovely episode, though. Really funny. Very, very interesting talking to him. Lots in common as well with the talking about youth movements and talking about the joy of singing the songs and so on. And very generous with his time as ever.
Absolutely. The conversation flowed so long, we suddenly realised we'd been talking for 2 hours and we tried to keep this to a 1 hour more or less show. So we've edited out the bits that we're worried will be litigious because we told too many very naughty stories about what we used to get up to at summer camps.
So for those of you that remember summer camps and for those of you that wish you'd been on summer camps, sit back and enjoy the show. Hello, I'm Philip Simon.
And I'm Rachel Krieger. We are two Jewish comedians. I'm Orthodox, so in my youth movement, when we sat around the campfire, we'd sing Gesher Tzar Me'od and eat bisley.
And I'm Reform, so in my youth movement, when we sat around the campfire, we'd sing Crocodile Rock and eat marshmallows. This show is the audio equivalent of improvisation. You never know what's going to happen. We're always open to suggestions, and quite often, someone's left going, "Yes, and?"
In each episode, we chat to our favourite Jews about their lives and experiences growing up and how much Jewishness plays a part. Are they American pie or Lokshen pudding?
Welcome to Jew Talking to Me.
Let's introduce our guest. He's a playwright, producer and creator of shows including Whose Line Is It Anyway?, Mock the Week and Room 101. It's Dan Patterson. Hello.
Hello. Hello. I was delighted what you said about the youth groups because I was the person playing American Pie in my youth group. And when I did it, that song was quite new. And, but I never did that. I was not a great fan of the marshmallows. I could got too sticky.
I knew about you and the Kumsitz guitar playing because obviously we know each other from Limud Festival, where you are famous for bringing your guitar and sitting down for a little jam with American Pie, etc., etc.
Yeah, I do. Well, I love doing that. I've always loved doing song leading, and I used to do it at Habonim camps. And you learn, I mean, it's a bizarre set of songs. You know songs from about you know, the 60s and the 70s, we had a lot of anti-war songs. We used to sit there playing in anti-Vietnam songs way after the Vietnam War was finished. And it was just a bizarre collection. The people who were my madrachim, you know, they loved folk music. It was very privileged that we got to know a lot of songs. And there's a guy called Simon who I used to do the things with. And I've done them at Limud with him where we sort of do these singing things. And I'm in a group called Jonah and the Wailers, and we do bar mitzvahs and weddings and things, usually our own rather than anybody else's. But we also get that. Me and my brother Phil and Joe Brooks and Simon Stiles. And that's it, five of us, yeah.
I love that. No matter what youth movement you went to, like could be Habonim, it could be B'nai Akiva, it could be study group, it could be whatever, we all used the RSY songbook. That was like the main guide when we were teenagers.
Because what happened was there were two people in Habonim who took over RSY, I think in sort of the late 70s, early 80s, maybe mid 80s, and made it very similar to how it had been in Habonim. So I think that Chiron was very close to the Habonim one. Maybe the difference was the Habonim Hebrew songs were all from the 1940s. It was sometimes I play a song to Israelis and they burst out laughing because they go, you know, that's like playing Green Sleeves. I mean, it's just so ancient, these things. But there's a certain group of songs, and I always joke if somebody says, do you know this song? And I go, no, it's after 1973, so I have no idea what it is. But, you know, it was nice to see in that my kids all went to RSY. So seeing in the RSY songbook songs of the 80s and 90s and things, which I thought were tremendously modern, but just meant they weren't 40 years out of date. They were 30 years out of date.
I was RSY, so obviously you're welcome for the songbook, first of all. But it was that thing where you went each year to the summer camp, and then a really big part of it was opening up the songbook, the Chiron, for the first time and working out which songs were new. And they never got rid of old, really old songs. You'd have Maxwell's Silver Hammer. And then you got Psycho Killer, fa, fa, fa. It was such a bizarre...
Oh, Psycho Killer was so far into the future for us.
And then you've got someone trying to work it out on the guitar as they're sitting around the campfire. One poor kid trying to work it out on the guitar.
I want to tell you one terribly embarrassing thing was when I was a kid, I made up this little slightly embarrassing song, which I'm not going to repeat, but it was called Little Red Socks. And I used to sing it, and my brother knew this song. Anyway, somewhere, and I meet somebody with an old accent, I said, well, were you in Habonim? And they said, yeah. And I said my name, and they said, oh, you wrote Little Red Socks. And this had appeared in the Habonim Chiron, in the Habonim songbook. And everybody was singing it. And I said, well, can you sing it? And she sang it. And I went, oh, the tune's a bit different to how I remember. She said, no, that's just because I'm tone deaf. And I tell you, I was mortified that this song...
Mortified? That's like your moment of absolute fame.
Well, there's only two things I will be remembered for. One is that... And one is I wrote this thing with Mark Leveson, actually, called The Conscience Play, which was in Habonim for years and years. Every generation of people who've gone through it have done this at some camp. And people always know that play. It was quite a serious thing. We did it in a tent in about 1980 or 81. And it won a prize somewhere. And I haven't seen it since we wrote it.
I feel like we should do it now, except for none of us have prepared for it.
I think now's the time to tell you we're not actually recording. And we could probably sing Little Red Socks if you'd like to.
I'm just between, Phil,
it's just between us.
Too embarrassing.
People, it's just us here.
Just the kind of thing that should be left within family folklore. But I love the way that these kids are all kind of singing it seriously. And I'm going, oh my God. That's my brother, Ben. That I blame that on him.
I do think the songs that we sung at summer camp were the most militant you would find us. So you'd join in with it. You'd do all the different voices, different parts, whatever.
Actions.
We used to have, oh God, the actions. We did Im Titzu, great Jewish song. They taught us his actions and claimed it was sign language.
Wow.
Was it not?
Wow. Well,
I don't think it was.
That we could do for Swing Low. But Habonim was very left-wing, very socialist. And we had one song, which was to the tune of Green Grow the Rushes, and it was Red Fly the Banners O. And I can't remember... all the words, but we honestly, I think it was 10 for the days that shook the world, 9 for the days of the general strike, 8 for the 8th Red Army. Wow.
Goodness.
7 for the days of the working week, 6 for the Tolpuddle martyrs, 5 for the years of the 5-year plan, 4 for the years it took them, 3, 3, the rights of man, 2, 2, the workers' hands working for us living, 1 is workers' unity and evermore shall be so. But we were really singing about 5 for the years of the 5-year plan and 4 for the years it took them and going, how about the tens of millions they killed doing it? I mean, we could have sung that, for example, but wow.
I mean, that's a good song, but it's no Little Red Socks.
It's no Little Red Socks. I'm telling you, this is now going to be the thing. It's going to turn Little Red Socks into a surprise number one.
Was Little Red Socks like a lament about this poor sock that gets left in the washing machine?
No,
and turns everything else pink?
I wish it had. had that much pathos and structure. No, I'm telling you, you're not going to get it out of me. It's just too embarrassing.
Kiva in the UK when I was growing up, and I think still really, it was apolitical. Like in other countries, it isn't. But here it was an apolitical youth movement. So we did sing some of those songs, but also we did lots of really like well-meaning activities. There was one called Bureaucratic Breakfast. That's one I remember very specifically that you did every year at camp. And Bureaucratic Breakfast was supposed to be so we understood how it felt to be a refusenik in Russia. So like a Jew who wasn't allowed to practice their religion or get out, and they were being sent from pillar to post. So, you know, you'd go to get your breakfast, you'd try and get a bowl, and they say you can't get a bowl, so you've got a Weetabix. Can't get a Weetabix, so you've got a spoon, you can't get a spoon. It was, I don't know why, we sort of knew, oh, that's like fondly, we thought, oh, that's coming up soon. What a terrible thing.
Well, all I'm hearing from that is you had Weetabix, which is incredible. We had cornflakes, that was it. Often we had our morning tea in a cup that smelled of last night's vegetable soup. Because there was no proper washing up. But can I also say, on the youth group front, thinking about it recently, there was no health and safety whatsoever.
Oh, of course
it's
not,
extraordinary how people didn't die. Because we used to have we would dig what was called a bog pit. This was a pit where all the effluents was emptied into. And there was also another pit which where all the food waste was. And then we would do these things playing games at night called a wide game where everyone was running around. And every year, somebody would fall in the bog pit. Every year. And I remember there was one guy, a madrasa, said to the kid, "Why did you fall in the bog pit?" And he said, "I wanted to see how far I could lean over without falling into it." But how do people not die? I just don't get it. I remember we played a wide game. A friend of mine was very tall, and they blew the whistle to start this wide game, and he ran into a metal plow. And in my mind, it was like in a cartoon where he just hit it with his head and he was out cold. And this sort of thing happened all the time. I think it's marvellous now. I'm sure they don't do this now. But at that time...
No, I'm sure they have much more health and safety. I remember when I was on one of the camps we did, it was a camping one. Normally, we were in schools and you had dormitories and things. But we were camping, so we had portaloos. And I was the head cook on this camp, which also would suggest that no health and safety has gone into this whatsoever. I must have been just in my early 20s and suddenly I'm head cook. But I had access to the portaloos before anyone else arrived. So I took one and I put an out of order sign on it. And that was my toilet for 2 weeks. And
brilliant.
And it's, if anyone saw me sneaking in, I'd have to be, "Oh, I'm just checking it. I've got to check it's still not working." Yeah, not working. When they came to empty it after week one, the guy's like, "Oh, this is out of order. I'll get to that." I was like, "No, don't worry. It's fine. It's just my little thing." And then I confessed to it on the last night by giving this whole speech to the camp about what I had done. And to this day, people still reference it as the prank they remember that was played. I had my own personal toilet.
And was this a Hessian? We sort of had a Hessian...
No, we had that bog tent. Structure.
No, no, these were proper
toilets. They had proper toilets.
You know, RSY, proper portaloos.
It was portaloo with blue liquid. It's like a Smurf had died in.
Yes.
And which he probably would, by the way. Flies everywhere. And oh God, it was warm.
Not in mine. My toilet, there were no flies.
We had like sort of barrels with toilet seats on, and you had to put kind of lye or something like powder on top of what you did. There was no flushes. There was no blue water.
There was obviously no flushes.
No
flushes. We would have died and gone to heaven if we'd had a flush. We had this Hessian sack.
When my younger son, who's like now nearly 19, when he started going to camp and they had like portaloos, I was so angry. And then he said they had disposables. I said, "What do you mean? Do you not do washing up? Do you not have Tora Nuts and do your washing up?" And he said, "No, you just chuck it all in a bag." I went absolutely mad. I called the Marcos up there, keep saying, "What about the environment? I don't care about the environment. I just think he should have to wash stuff up."
My first camp proper when I was 13, I went 2 weeks without going to the loo. I was just so horrified by the loo. 2 weeks. I mean, you couldn't do that now. But I also want to say, health and safety, there was this guy who decided one day to wake up everybody. This was going to be a hilarious thing to do with one of those huge mallets that you used to put up a marquee. And he was going to go bang on the side of all the bell tents with this mallet. And in my mind, he was doing this. And the next thing was St. John's Ambulance taking out a kid who'd been standing up within the bell tent. And he smashed on the head while he was waking everybody up. The same guy, by the way, we did a camp in Holland, where, by the way, we had to take kosher Edam cheese into the country. And the customs were incredibly suspicious of this. I mean, it was actually to the place where they made it. But there was a sort of place, and it had a pond in front of it with green algae. And it was sort of dusk, and the group after us arrived, and this guy Arthur came running up to us. And me and Matt Levinson were standing there watching, it might have been Simon as well, watching him just run into this pond, which he thought was a lawn, because it was up to his neck in this thing. And none of us had the wherewithal to say, stop, don't run into that, because it's a pond. But this is what it was like.
Simpler times.
It made us all who we are.
Yes.
We have a strong memory of my husband, Mark, his cousin Benji was in my year in BA, and he was always very naughty and up to pranks and stuff. But I do remember that we were at camp. It was winter camp at some boarding school. In the summer, we were in tents, in the winter, we'd be in a school. And someone shouted from like the bottom of where the dorms were really loudly, quick, quick, Reisman's built a raft. And then we all watched him, like he just gathered bits of stuff from around the campus and he was like floating out onto this massive pond, like what you're talking about. I mean, it was made of what, bits of string and chewing gum and like some old pipe and a box and whatever, and we just all watched him sort of floating and sinking.
Well, everybody watched the raft. So my friend Joe Brooks spent 2 days making a raft for the camp, which then all the kids were on it and it sank.
Yeah, they should have made them out of marshmallows.
Brilliantly brought back.
We're talking about youth groups. What was the affiliation of Hub and Im? Because obviously RSY is reform, BA is too much.
It wasn't reform and it wasn't orthodox. There wasn't a lot of religion at all. I mean, on a Friday night, you know, we do a Kabbalat Shabbat with some songs and somebody would probably read an Anne Frank reading or something. We had a theme for a camp every year. I mean, the camp that I remember very strongly when I was 13, our one was the Aztecs, and we had to get up every morning and say, yeah, I know, it was sort of not Jewish. I know, just this one year, they didn't do it Jewish, but we had various ones. We had the shtetl, but I don't think we had much religion. There was a lot of, you know, sort of ruach and Jewish spirit, and there was quite a lot of, you know, educational stuff, but it didn't tend to be based on it. And we absolutely didn't do grace after meals. All my cousins who were at B'nai Akiva can do the whole of benching. I'm always incredibly impressed. Not just the short little bit you do, but the whole thing. And they
and 10 that. Extra songs that you shove on at the end. We've all got
the banging on the table. And
No, we would have thought this was just absurd. But I like it now. I like a bit of benching. But we didn't do that. We were too serious, I guess. Although, actually, it was, and I'm sure it was the same at your youth groups, the thing that held it together, I think, was a sense of humour. I think if you had a good sense of humour, you thrived there. And I remember laughing hugely. And it was also great for creativity, that when you were a Madrid, you had to come up with a way to do an educational programme with the kids. Yeah. And you had to find creative ways to do it. And, you know, when you think of all the things youth group gave us, it gave us the ability to talk in front of groups, to be creative, to be confident, to have, I think, a greenhouse effect. Because when we were kids, we had Madrachim, who were all doing drama and history and art and music. And we had them giving us all that time and attention in a way that I think you didn't have unless you went to a sort of drama school or a music school or something like that. So I think we all have a lot to thank for youth groups. You couldn't have had a better sort of informal education.
Absolutely. Don't know whether this is going to get me into trouble or not, but we took with Whose Line Is It Anyway? Book of Games to one camp.
The thing with Whose Line was that there was one game which we took from Have On Him called Camps Charlie, where somebody put their arms through and whatever. But I remember somebody, maybe my friend Kenny, they did a scene, I think it was David and Goliath, and they did it straight. And then they said, do it again, but do it very fast. And then do it again, but do it in slow motion. And that had a real effect on me. I just thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen and the most incredibly different thing I'd ever seen. You see, one of the things for us about Have On Him was I went to an all-boys school, and suddenly you're going to Have On Him where there's girls. And it was just fantastic in that regard. But can I also say, you bring up Whose Line, that as a sort of neurotic Jewish guy full of angst, you could not have a show that was less suited to my temperament, because at the beginning of the night, you have absolutely nothing. And most of what happens, you can't control. And it is utterly terrifying. This is why I look this old. I have done 35 years of Whose Line, and it is absolutely terrifying. There's no other word. And it maybe became less in the last you know, once we got to America and really knew what we were doing and had people that, you know, you just knew. But when we started off, we obviously had brilliant people like Josie Lawrence, John Sessions, Paul Merton, Tony Snattery, Sandy Toksvig, Mike McShane, Greg Proops, all wonderful, all brilliant. But we didn't know how to do it quite as well then. So, I mean, the thing that I still remember to this day was, you know, about our third series, we decided to do it in New York, which was a really bad idea. But I thought, we got so many Americans on the show, let's do it in their home territory. And we're doing it in New York. And of course, nobody knows any of the English performers. So none of them know Josie Lawrence. None of them know any of these people. So all the people that by this point were quite big stars in England and therefore come out, and as you will know from doing stand-up, if people know you and they're excited to see you, they're already, you've already won half the battle. And suddenly nobody, you know, John Sessions, who was incredible in England, just utterly went down the pan. And in those days we do like 8 games and then we finish and then I do another 8 games. After 8 games of this one, the first one in America, we had nothing, just nothing had worked. So I was busy with the director and the people up in the box going, right, let's do this game, let's do this game. And the floor manager said, you better come down, everybody is leaving. And it is the most terrifying thing that I went down and there was half the audience left. And I said, please, we haven't finished. I begged them to stay, because obviously you can't do improv without an audience. You know, if you're doing a sitcom, you could do it and then conceivably dub something in, but can't do improv without it. And that is my worry dream even now. That even now, if I'm stressed about something, I dream that the audience is just leaving. And it just is the most terrifying, terrifying thing.
So we're getting a sense of what kind of Jew you are. Obviously, the Habonim thing, your background there, the angst-ridden Jew. You know that Rachel's Orthodox and I'm Reform, but outside of showbiz and outside of the youth groups, what kind of Jew are you?
Well, I don't go to shul very much, but I belong to Aleph, which is a very good synagogue, very wonderful people. It's Reform. I didn't grow up Reform. I grew up in Oxford, which is traditional. And Oxford does have this amazing thing that they have one building which is shared by the Orthodox and Reform. So on any Shabbat you can go there, and then one part of the building there'll be an Orthodox service and another part there'll be Reform, and they get on very well and they'll all come together at the end. There's no animosity, which I always thought was great. And it's a wonderful community. My mother's very old and they come and visit her. They take the stuff. It's got a lot of people. I mean, the weird thing is, you know, in any synagogue you grew up in, you were the youngster, you were the kid, and now you've turned into one of the alter kakas. I mean, it's just, you know, that's a terrifying thing. And also, I like happy clappy. I have to admit, cards on table, I am Dan Patterson and I like a happy clappy service. So I like a guitar, or I like piano or organ. No, less organ. I don't mind an organ. But to me, the thing that lifts me, gets me more spiritual, is music. That is when I can feel a magic. And in Oxford, they really didn't have this. And everybody's singing in their own key and chanting away. There's a lot of very good synagogues I go to around here for people's bar mitzvahs and stuff. You know, but people just do their own thing. It's the Orthodox thing of just davening your own thing. And having been 35 years in Reform, I'm very used to a congregation doing everything together. You know, if you do Kaddish, everyone does it together. It's that thing rather than being on your own more. Can I tell you my synagogue story, which I won't mention the synagogue, but I went along to the shul and they said, have you got a phone? And I went, yeah. And they said, well, you've got to hand it in. And I'm very, as you know, from trying to set up this Zoom, very technophobe. My whole life is on this phone. I don't know how to copy it. If I lost my phone, I'm dead. And I went, no, I'm not going to hand it in, but I've turned it off. And they said, no, you've got to hand it in. And I went, no, I've turned it off. And they said, but you might turn it back on. And I went, I'm about to go to shul. If I tell you I'm turning it off, I'm not going to lie. I'm turning it off. They said, no, you can't. And I said, well, I'm not coming in. And I walked off. And then I thought, this bluff of mine isn't really working, because I've come to science bar mitzvah. I have to go in. I was just furious. I thought, this is just ridiculous. Anyway, afterwards, I was talking to people and they all said, well, you should do what we do. You should just say you haven't got your phone with you. And I went, so the first thing you want me to do when I go into synagogue is lie and have a phone, but not say that I've got a phone. Anyway, that's my Larry David kind of moment of, for goodness sake, Dan, just hand in your phone. But it was this moment of saying, well, I won't come in then. And the guy, you know, is like, okay, so don't come in. We don't care, don't come. I was like, ah, okay, that was my final gambit there. If he's not going for that, then I'm stuck.
So I've never heard of being asked to hand it in, like in school, you know, like it's registration.
Well, I was just very irritated by going, I'm giving you my word that I'm not going to turn it on, but I don't want, yeah. I want it on me. I want here, look, I want this in my pocket so I know I have all that information and you're not going to lose it. And that was...
Yeah. But also, it's quite an odd thing to make that the rule that you have to hand it in, because they might say, there's no smoking inside, give us your cigarettes, give us your e-cigarette, whatever. They trust you on some things. They obviously don't trust people not to take photos or...
Well, I don't think it's the photos. I think people apparently do switch them on. I mean, I went to a wedding, not there. It was actually at West London. A lovely wedding, very, very nice family. But I was sitting there and Man United happened to be playing Arsenal that afternoon. And there were four people behind me who were all Arsenal fans. I'm a Man United fan. And suddenly I heard one of them go, yes! And I was like, oh, shit. You know, it's like, oh, I was really enjoying this. And now I'm just annoyed. And then there was another thing where they were, oh, and they went, Man United have equalised. I said, fine. And then Man United, I think, went ahead and they went, it's extra, it's injury time. We're injury time. Okay, great, we're going to win this. And then you hear, yes! And then you hear another, yes! And so they won 3-2. And my whole experience of this bar mitzvah was these Arsenal fans behind me on their phones watching their team beat my team.
If they didn't want to be spotted, all they need to do was shout Mazel Tov instead when there was
a that would have been great.
Mazel Tov,
well, Mazel Tov. When it hasn't happened yet, when they're just walking around and doing the Sheva Brothers.
I'm so excited for this wedding.
I want to know what happened in that shul, the one where you have to hand your phones in. Like, there was clearly some
It's a very wonderful shul, and I know a lot of great people there, so I don't want to cast aspersions, because they are very good. I go there quite a lot. And by the way, oh, they do a great Kiddush. Oh, I mean, the herring. I love a good herring. I love herring. In Oxford, when I was growing up, this may be unfair and maybe it's changed, but as a kid, I remember there wasn't much. It was like peanuts and crisps and things. Whereas some of these things in London, you have chullant and you have the, you know, the whole thing. An Aelith, you know, has a... has its herrings and all this sort of stuff. I've asked some of these synagogues, can I just turn up for the Kiddush? And they always say yes, but then you feel you can't inside. You can't do that, can you? It's just not done.
So in my community, at one point, I had the nickname JFK because I would turn up
just for Kiddush. That's great.
Well, we've been talking a lot about the past, but what is the most Jewish thing that's happened to you recently, Dan?
I want to just delve back into this, because one of the things that I find is when you fly to a normal country, so you say you're going to Sweden, or you're going to Iceland, or you're going to France, you're going to just somewhere normal, and you get on the plane, everybody's got just the right amount of hand luggage to put into the overhead thing. Everyone just puts it in, and it's calm, and they sit down, and that's fine. When you go El Al or anywhere to Israel, everybody has brought a fridge, which they didn't want to pay to check in. So they got the fridge and 9 huge suitcases and live chickens, which they're all trying to put into the overhead luggage. And, you know, I have to say that I like to get on a plane very early, so I know I've got my bag there. And this is always a fight. It's always a fight. And I was on a plane to Israel, and it was on Pesach. It wasn't actually the day of Pesach, but it was during the 8 days. It was EasyJet, and they said, we've got a Jewish option, which is a smoked salmon and cream cheese bagel. And I went, this is tragic, because they've really tried. You've got to say, they've got a Jewish option. How lovely. But I went up to the guy and I said, I bet you haven't sold many of these today. And he said, no, usually we have a whole lot, but nobody's going for this today. And you just go, I wanted to praise the effort, but maybe there just wasn't quite the education there knowing what was going to work during Pesach. I suppose another Jewish thing, I mean, it's more the angsty side, I guess, but I can't fly anywhere. So I just flew to Australia over Christmas, and I can't go anywhere without spending 50 quid in boots before I get on the plane, because I'm just going, well, I might need that. I might need that. And here's my admission. This is like my little Red Sox admission. Here's my admission. I cannot go anywhere without a packet of Imodium.
Right.
Despite the fact that in my life, I've probably had the runs really badly once or twice when I was out. I mean, it just never happens. But I have Imodium. And the reason I have Imodium is when I was on my year course thing, I was going from Ashkelon to Jerusalem with my friends Simon and Kenny. And we'd had a lot of fruit. It was from friends of my parents. And I got on the bus, and within 15 minutes, I knew I was in trouble. I was in real, real trouble on this bus. And I don't know if you've been through this, but you're sitting there going, saying to the driver, how long? And this was at a time when you could say to the driver, can you please stop? Because and they just wouldn't. No one was stopping. So we got to Jerusalem. By this point, I'm sweating. And I say to Simon, just find me a cubicle. Find me a cubicle. I don't care where. Just find me. And I remember dashing in, and Simon is banging on these doors, and finally one of them opens, and it's a Haredi guy. And again, in my imagination, he drags him out, throws me in. Complete relief, obviously no toilet paper. So I had to use the Jerusalem Post. And I feel that was my real sort of, you know, connection. That was my, what's it called when you have to do a thing at a fraternity?
Hazing?
No, not hazing. You go through an initiation. That was my initiation, the whole thing. That's why, to this day, I go nowhere without Imodium.
Can I ask why you go nowhere without Imodium, but you rely on the fact there will be toilet paper wherever you go?
That's a brilliant question.
You just have the Jerusalem Post tucked under your arm.
I now have many different papers on me. No, I just, I usually have a sort of tissue knocking around, but I find maybe this is just a change in the world, and we are talking about the really significant stuff today, I'm aware of that, but maybe there's just more toilet paper in cubicles. When was the last time you were in a cubicle where there was no toilet paper? I don't remember that.
Happened to me recently.
What did you do?
I did what women do, which is you call out and someone passes it under the cubicle door.
So is that why we call the festival Pass Under? There is a Jewish story I wanted to tell, though. This is something that is sort of connected to a memory. Is on the night before my own bar mitzvah, my father was a great guy, and he taught Hebrew at Oxford. He taught modern Hebrew literature, post-biblical Hebrew. Very learned, very nice, very quiet, very calm. You know, I went up to bed and I called him. I said, I'm really nervous, Dad. I don't know how I'm going to do, and I just can't sleep. He said, look, you're going to be absolutely fine. I will be on the bimah behind you, and I will be there. And if necessary, I will guide you through it. Don't worry. And I said, thanks, Dad. Lovely moment. Shut my eyes. Went to sleep. Great. Fast forward, I don't know, however many years, 25, 30 years. And my own son is the night before his bar mitzvah. And he's, you know, he's very nervous as well, very edgy about the whole thing. And remembering this stuff, I said, Louis, it's going to be fine. I'm going to be there with you. I will be standing behind you on the bimah. And if necessary, I can guide you through it. And he went, but you know nothing. And I thought, oh, why can't I have these Kodak moments? Why can't these wonderful moments, you know, that you see in dramas and things, why can't they happen to me? It's just, I was there. And it was great, of course. There was absolutely nothing I would have been able to do. But these are the things of maximum stress, aren't they?
Philip's stand-up has got a lot of quite similar stories about his boys, I think.
I've had to rein it in a bit, actually. People have started offering me help after gigs. When I talk about just how awful it can be, I've got a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old who I love dearly, but they are a challenge. I do have this theory that whenever we go anywhere, by the time we leave that place, everyone in that place knows my children's name. There's so much angst. And
there's a lot of angst about all that stuff. Yeah, I agree.
But they're great. You know, they're wonderful. I wouldn't be without them.
A friend of mine called Adam, on his bar mitzvah, he said that he was up there and he was facing the hall and he was doing his piece. And he suddenly saw his father and uncle and some cousins jump up and go dashing off. And he's doing his piece. And then he sees them all come rushing back in, each carrying a box. This is the back of the hall, each carrying a box. And afterwards, he found out that they'd forgotten any wine for the Kiddush. And they'd all gone to the nearest off-license during him doing his bit as they were.
Wow.
Everybody
That's amazing.
This. Well, we've all got those stories, haven't we?
It does sound like there's a lot of stuff going on, like to do with being Jewish, stuff in the past, in childhood. We always like to check in with our guests and find out how they're doing and ask the very important question, what's the matter, Bubbler? So, Dan, what's grinding your gears right now?
There's two different things. One is just getting old, you know, just being older. The things that you used to be able to do, you know, making noises when you sit down, making noises if you bend over, making noises. I mean, just getting in and out of the bath. It's just getting harder. I find that, you know, all things that you would do in the past and you'd absolutely bounce off. And I look at younger people and I am quite envious of that. I don't think I'm growing old with grace. You know, I'm just full of bitterness and envy. So that's one thing. But The other thing, and this was sort of coming up because it happened a lot around Christmas time, is people putting all in newspapers things saying the 50 best comedies of all time, best 50 best comedy films. If it's anything to do with TV, by the way, my stuff, even there was one on TV on Channel 4, it was the best 100 improv moments ever. I've done, I think, the one show of improv of that sort of thing that's really worked both here and in America and around the world. Surely I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be in the top 10. Surely so. Anyway, 97 was one bit from Whose Line. And they didn't even ask me. They asked the guy at that time who directed it. And it was like, how do I not get on an improv best of? But those countdowns always drive me mad for two reasons. One is the best comedy is always Some Like It Hot, which drives me crackers. Because while I think it's a very good film, because Billy Wilder made great films, it's not the best comedy. It's not funny. It's just not. Even The Apartment is more funny than that. It's just not funny. And I go, have you never seen Airplane or Naked Gun or Groundhog Day or Life of Brian or Meet the Parents? All these. And of course, no, because they're lower brow. So no, we've got to do something that's highbrow because it's Billy Wilder. And I'm going, Tony Curtis decides 2/3 of the way through the film to put on a Cary Grant accent, which he carries on doing all the way. Now, if I had been producing that, I'd have gone, Tony, it's going to be fine for a couple of lines, but it's going to be a millstone. Let's drop that, shall we? It's brilliantly constructed, as I say, because Billy Wilder was brilliant, but it's just not funny. So that's one of the ones that annoys me. And I know I should let this drip over me and let, you know, my father used to say, let it wash over you, but I can't. It just annoys. Or they have the, I mean, I know it's sort of not PC anymore, but they have the top 50 Woody Allen films. And when all the ones I liked are about number 25 and 24, I'm going, right, this is just ridiculous because what you're going to put at the top are not his best films. And I know my way around comedy. So these things, I guess it's other people's opinions. I think other people's opinions are increasingly annoying me.
It's other people's opinions because obviously it depends who's voting for these things, or is it a PR push?
No, it's usually one person. These days, one person is some critic's idea. By the way, critics, I mean, that's another thing that really annoys me is I've got to the point with the Guardian critic and one or two others, film critics, I should say, that if they like a film, I won't like it, and vice versa. In fact, with most film critics, I guess the snobbiness. You know, this year, I think The Holdovers is fantastic. I think American Fiction is fantastic. But I would be very surprised if they won anything, because they're not seen as weighty, like, you know, the Scorsese, what's it called, Killers of the Flower Moon, or these things. I'm sure they will do it. But I just think, with the world in the state it is, aren't we okay just laughing or just having a story that's great? You know, where's The Sting? Where's Amadeus? Where's Goodfellas? I mean, I know Goodfellas isn't a particular laugh, but I'm just saying, a film with a great story. I just want to escape into a wonderful film. Hit the right
time? Oh, absolutely. And I love what you're saying about the countdown thing of the best of. I'm so pleased to get you on the podcast just before Purim, obviously, because we're bringing out our top 100 guests that we've had on the list. And you're in the running. You're very much in the running. Man.
It's all
I'll
between what happens between now and the end of this podcast. I thought you were going to say we're bringing in our 10 top festivals and there's going to be a countdown. Well, you know, because surely everybody's favourite's got to be Pesach, hasn't it? The Seder night, isn't that full of wonderful memories?
I think
my dad used to do a great Seder. He used to do a great Seder. My mother was always going, David, we've got to get on with it. The chicken's burning, whatever it is, it's all going to be too well done. And he was talking about doxologies and how Rabbi Akiva said this. And the fact is they were probably plotting the Bar Kokhba rebellion on this particular bit. Yep. All the stuff that he used to bring out. And I just have such wonderful, happy memories of Seder. And when you were a kid, you know, staying up that late, you know, and it was just so exciting. And you didn't have a kid's Haggadah in those days. I don't know whether that's good or
did
bad.
Did you not have the one with the bits you could pull along and fold them?
Yeah, the pop-up.
Except that obviously somebody had pulled it too hard 3 years earlier, so it didn't really
Moses
work.
Out of the basket. Yeah, that's the worst.
And
that's
also hiding the Afikoman, you know, and all of that. It's so magical. And people saying, why don't we have eggs in salt water every day of the year? You know, all these things that everybody says and everybody's doing in their own ones. That one and Hanukkah. I think Hanukkah has really strong memories for me as something very... You felt very safe and cozy and excited. And there were the candles there and you had your presents. that to me was very magical. You know, I'm sure I should say Tish B'Av or Shavuot or something, but, or what's it called? Simchat Torah, where you walked around with a flag which had glitter on it and an arc thing would open and there was a slightly mangy apple,
on the top
of the flag. The apple.
Do you and a candle on the top. We used to do a flag with a wooden stick and an apple and then a candle. A lit candle.
Well, health and safety. What is going on?
No health and safety. And nothing happens. Like, I don't remember growing up.
You got sweets on the way out.
Also, this is another thing. In Oxford, I don't know if it's the case now, but when I was growing up, nobody threw sweets. And then when I came to London and started going to other places, everybody threw sweets. Does this still happen? Because I always think it's kind of dangerous.
With Simchat Torah, it was that we got sweets on the way out. It was whoever was Chatan Torah Bereshit, whatever that was. They would give out like a Kit Kat and a Mars bar or something on the way out as a treat. But it was at Bar Mitzvahs in Israel. That was the first time I saw sweet throwing, where the kid finishes and then the sweets get thrown.
Is that a reform Orthodox thing? Because we always did it.
I don't know. I literally never knew they went to synagogue until we were invited to the Bar Mitzvah, because it was Israel. You don't really have to do being Jewish, because it's like being Christian here. It just happens.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that's a... Am I right in thinking that some of the people who will listen to the podcast are not Jewish? Because this might sound insane, that we're walking around with a flag with a rotten apple on it and a little thing that opens and you just walk round and round with it. And that's it. Funny enough, in our synagogue in America, where we lived for a while, on Simchat Torah, they opened the whole scroll down the corridor. So you could see what it was like, which I thought was fascinating. You know, everyone held it up and you did it all the way down. That's, by the way, another thing. You said the most Jewish thing is I turned down, what's it called, where you lift up the Torah? What's Hagba. That called? Hagba. I turned that down because I thought I'm going to do my back in. I am just, you know, like that scene at the beginning of The Odd Couple where he's trying to open the window to jump out the hotel room. I thought, I'm going to lift it up. I'm going to do my back in. I'm going to drop it and everyone's going to have to fast. And I just said, no, thank you for the honor, but I'm not going to do it because I will do my back in. I just know I'm going to do it. You know, there's all these festival related accidents. I mean, I don't want to make fun of, but I've been to quite a lot of funerals lately. And I'm always worried that when you do the digging thing to throw the soil onto the coffin, that I'm going to do my back in there. That it just would be a terrible time to do back in.
If they made a Jewish spin-off of Casualty, that's what it would be like. It would be Jews sitting at home on their sofa watching, you know, people going in for Simchat Torah with the flags. They're going, oh, no, what's going to happen here? Someone's eye is going to go out.
No, I think it's
to lift
like...
the Torah. They'll be like, oh, they're going to do their back in and everyone's going to have to fast.
You know, there was this program, Animal Hospital. I think they should have Jew Hospital, where people come in with Jewish-related accidents, you know, things that they've done. And you get some very nice people sitting around saying, so what happened? You say, well, I sat on the flag with the apple, or, you know, I did my back in at the funeral. The sad thing is that the thing that I go to most now, you know, you go through a period where you go to everyone's bar mitzvah and then you have everyone's wedding. And then you have a period where it's Brits, don't you? I mean, I know I was at my own Brit, but I'm going to say Brit. I'm not going down the Ashkenazi thing. I'm going to say Brit. You go to these things and you have them. And then it's your kids' friends, bar and bat mitzvahs, and then weddings and all this stuff. But I'm going to a lot of funerals, and it's just at the various places where they're squeezing you in every half hour. So you arrive then, you know, millions of people from the next one.
With those funerals, the back-to-back funerals, that sometimes they remind me of, you know, in Shaun of the Dead, there's a scene where they meet another group of friends coming the other way who are slightly better actors or slightly more famous actors coming the other way. I sometimes think, you know, if you're going to a Lavoie, which is like an obligation one rather than you really want to be there, and then you see people coming out who are like all your mates from another
bit more fun. It would have been a bit more fun.
It's
it's one of those things that you're going through at the stage.
We've attended back-to-back funerals. We had
really who was facing the coffin.
we had someone at,
did you bring a picnic?
We should have brought a picnic. They don't cater funerals. You have to go to the house. But so we had one, I think it was about 1 o'clock, and one at 3 o'clock, and there was crossover, but we had to be at both. Then there was the year that we went to the stone setting for my wife's grandparents, who had died a month apart, so they kind of did it all same sort of time. But we went to the wrong cemetery because we'd forgotten where they'd been buried.
This is your wife's grandparents?
Yeah.
Can I tell you another Have On Him story? My brother once was at a camp. I wasn't at this camp, but my friend Steve Yentis was there, was a doctor. And my brother, who was a madrich, you know, he wasn't like a 13-year-old kid. He was already 16, 17, went up to him and said, look, I've got a bit of a problem here. And he said, what? He said, my penis has turned blue. He said, what? He says, it's turned blue. I'm dying. It's turned blue. And Steve said, okay. So let me ask you a question. Did you just go swimming in the river? And he said, yes. And he said, are you wearing blue underpants? And he went, yes. And he said, are they new? And he went, yes. He said, that might be your answer. You know, like him, we're a family where we always think it's the worst thing. You know Woody Allen's line where he says, I'm not a hypochondriac, but I think whatever I've got is going to kill me.
Yeah.
That's exactly where I am. I always go to the worst stage. So my brother was just thinking, and my father, by the way, once woke up in the middle of the night to look at the clock, you know, at a clock radio, and it was all blurry, just couldn't see anything. His eyes had gone. And he wakes up my mum and said, it's gone, it's happened. I finally, you know, whatever's happening to me, it's happening. I can't focus on the, you know, the figures on the clock. And my mum turned on the light and he was trying to read the clock through a glass of water.
We've talked a lot about food in and out of our stories. I heard about your fondness for a full-on kiddish. But as a Jewish mother, I do love to hear your connection.
I thought you were going to say, as a Jewish mother, and I was going, I can claim some things, but I'm not a Jewish mother. But you were saying you were a Jewish mother. Got it.
I am a Jewish mother. As a Jewish mother myself, I love to hear people's stories about their connection to traditional foods or experiences they've had around Jews and food. So do you have any like likes, dislikes, loves, hates or stories about Jewish food?
Yes. Well, my hate is, and I hate this so much that I sometimes wonder whether I am Jewish. And I want to do one of these DNA tests. It would be so great if it came out. I wasn't even Jewish and all of this was a waste. I mean, if you look at my face, you realize I probably am, but I don't like borscht. I just don't like beetroot.
I don't like it either.
People go on and on about, oh, borscht, and if you put the sour cream in it, I just don't like it. It's never done it for me. I just don't like beetroot, even though I know it's good for you. And it's good for your prostate, apparently. Hard to get it up there, but it is good. But anyway, chicken, roast chicken Friday nights. You know, if I was on death row, there's another happy thing, and I had my final meal, it would be a Friday night. I mean, you'd have to hope it was on a Friday, the day before. Yeah. I don't have to get into the whole scenario, this, but I just love a Friday night. I love the proper thing with, I say proper, but traditional, with chicken soup with matzo balls and the whole thing in it, and bits of chicken in it, because boiled chicken in chicken soup is fantastic. And then chopped liver. And then my mother used to make this thing called hatsi lim, which was aubergine sort of a thing like that. But I'm not such a fan of egg and onion because I'm not great with onion. I always think egg and onion, Rachel, sounds like a really bad Jewish comedy duo. I'm Peter Egg, I'm Sam Onion, and together we're egg and onion. But anyway,
let's do that. Our next gig that we're at together, let's do a sketch called Egg and Onion.
That'd just be one person in the corner going, what am I, chopped liver?
Hey, nice work for it. But having the roast chicken, and then afterwards you go and sort of pick up the carc and stuff. That's my idea of him. But there was also a thing I went to. I went to a do, and at this do, it was like, you know, a charity event. They had a sushi station, and I absolutely adore sushi. And they had a herring station. So I was able to have a whole lot of sushi. And I went to the herring station. And I went, you know what? I think I prefer, if really pushed, I think I prefer the herring. I think I actually do. And by the way, I mean, as you say, if you look at me, I couldn't be anything other than Jewish. I once went because I had a big operation to get rid of a tumor in my salivary gland, and there was a big scar left, and it went keloid, and I had to go and have this thing injected. And the nurse who was injecting it looked at me and said, have you ever thought of having a nose job? And it was like, no, but thank you. Thank you for mentioning it while you're sticking a needle in my neck. So, you know, I was thinking about the maestro and things like that, where they're talking about prosthetic noses. And, you know, I had no problem with Bradley Cooper's prosthetic nose. I didn't notice it after a minute. Golda Meir, you know, in Golda, I had no problem with prosthetics on that. I thought Helen Mirren did a great job. I just got over the prosthetics in 10 seconds and thought it was great. But I've always said, I'm a good friend of Jonathan Friedland. He was one of my kids in Habonim, one of my Hanichim. And I've always said to him, he would play me in the Hollywood version of my life. And he's never happy about that. It's the thing that really irritates him. I can see that he's going, I'm way better looking than Dan. But then I'm going, but the people who play you in Hollywood films are always better looking than you. You know, you see Rachel Weisz playing someone, whoever it is, and then you see the real person. What was the film about Rachel Weisz was in playing Deborah Lipstadt about the Holocaust denier?
The film is called Denial.
Denial. Andrew Scott played Anthony Julius. Yeah. And he's just brilliant. He could just play anything. I thought it was absolutely... Actually, there's a guy I know who was... He's a lawyer and he was portrayed in the film by someone. I thought, that sets him on a pedestal. He's been played in a movie by an actor.
It was Rachel Weisz, Timothy Spall as David Irving, the much disgraced, I think probably allowed to say.
Tim Spall's a very nice guy.
Tom Wilkinson, who sadly passed away not...
He did. He was great. He was great in the Full Monty. He was great in Marigold's Hotel. I loved Tom. I thought he was a great actor. That's the thing. I mean, look, there's so much awfulness in the world, but isn't it terrible people you really respect and loved have gone? You know, there's, for me, one after the other of the greats of the 1970s when, you know, that was my formative period in television. And, you know, you get Barry Norman going, and then you get John Noakes going, and then you get... You know, I mean, all at different times, I know, but just giants. And they've gone. I was very sad about Tom Wilkinson going. I thought he was terrific.
That makes me think of the Rebbitzins Disco at the end of Limud Festival, where Jacqueline Nichols, artist and DJ, she puts on an amazing disco, but it has a segment in it for the Jewish performers we have lost in the year, Jewish musical performers. And that's always like a key moment at that disco.
Well, it seems to happen more and more. It seems to happen more and more. I'll tell you a thing I'm working on. I'm working on a Jewish Price is Right. So Jewish Price is Right, where people from the audience have to come down and guess how much an item would be if they had an uncle in the business.
Excellent.
I think now's the time to pitch that show.
Yes.
I think they're clamouring for Jewish content. Not on Twitter, everywhere else.
And, you know, I didn't go into Bruges. We weren't a very Bruges family. But what's the difference between a Jewish Bruges and a non-Jewish Bruges? About 40 years. But it is interesting. As I said, non-Jewish, I'm reminded of Elon Gold, who's a wonderful Jewish comedian, absolutely brilliant. And he says it's so arrogant of Jews to call people who aren't Jewish non-Jews when it's basically everyone. It's everyone. Yeah. And we're saying they're not our tiny minority, they're everyone else.
We're like 0.02% of the world's population, but everyone else is a non-Jew.
Well, that is one of the statistics. It's 0.002% of the world population who are responsible for 70% of the anxiety. So it's,
and that's just in my house.
I think we punch above our weight in worries, definitely.
I'm just conscious of the time. Are you still all right for a bit?
Yeah, I am.
Quiet.
Yeah, yeah.
Kids quiet. Excellent.
Well, particularly now, Philip has said there's a countdown. You know, I just want to get my final.
You were doing great, but Elon Gold could steal it.
I'm telling you, Elon Gold would wipe the floor with my... He is very funny. Can I just say, I think I put this on some chat recently, but when I was in Habonim, there was a very nice...
You were in Habonim?
Yeah, did I mention that? Habonim Draw, I should say, because somebody will say Draw. We amalgamated with Draw in about 1981, and it's Habonim Draw. But anyway, there was this very nice woman called Ruth Steinman. And I once said to her, Ruth Steinman, it's lucky that you don't have a sister called Phyllis. And she said, I do have a sister called Phyllis. I mean, your sister is Phyllis Steinman. Phyllis Steinman. I mean, who does that? She might be listening. And I don't want to, you know, make this into a thing, but I did think that was a kind of, you know, when parents whose surname is Hamburger and they call their kid Amit, and you're just going, have you thought this through, the long-term implications of this? Philistine. Yeah. Hang on, have I got any other things I wanted to tell you?
I was just wondering what your best musical actually was. I know it was quite a while ago. The reason I'm asking, and I'm just saying, think about your answer carefully, is because Philip and I both come from musical theatre background, so this is quite an important issue for us.
Guys and Dolls is probably my favourite stage musical. I think there's not a line in it which either doesn't move the plot, doesn't move character, or is funny. And I just think it's so tight, and all the songs are credible. But I think the film version of Oliver was great. I think that's about, although I will get into an argument with various people about Fagin, because I think Fagin's a terrible character. I'm very worried that the stage version is coming back because, you know, the whole thing Ron Moody doing Oliver said, I will do it, but I'm not going to do it like the David Lean film. I'm going to turn Fagin into more of the heart of the story, into a lovable rogue, which he did. And then since it's come back on stage, I really worry about the Fagin character. I think it really drips into anti-Semitism and tropes, and also I don't like it. But the actual film with Ron Moody, I think, is a masterpiece. And there's a wonderful, it's a book called Genius and Anxiety. It's a terrific book in every regard, but there's a chapter about a woman, a Jewish woman's correspondence with Charles Dickens about how anti-Semitic a character Fagin was. And although, you know, it's still not great, she did manage to get him to make amendments. It's a wonderful thing. You know, it just shows the power of writing and being civil and how sensitive Charles Dickens was, that he was prepared to listen to her and make amends, I should say. And it's very, very good. I highly recommend that book. That's my plug for somebody else's work.
Philip's just choking. You're right there.
Yeah. You know what's happened is the results of the poll have come in and I moved from number 100 down to 99. And you can't believe that.
Well, is it like down to 99 or up to 99? I mean, technically,
well, do I get a flake?
Closer, you're one step closer to the prize.
You know how...
You can have a flake. There's a bath waiting for you.
Well, if you turn 100, you know, in the old days, the Queen would send you a telegram. I guess it's now King Charles sends you a telegram. But I thought, if you turn 99, do you get a flake?
Very good.
Do you know you have to apply for that? You don't get that automatically.
No.
My wife's grandfather who died, the one that we forgot where he was buried, 109 and a half he was. You have to apply for the card. So they did it at 100. I think they did it up to 105. They thought, well, we'll do it at the big ones only. And you also get a card from the Department of Work and Pensions, which feels quite passive aggressive. Yeah. It doesn't feel like they're celebrating you so much as wishing you would finally pop off because you're costing them money.
When he died, did you go, oh, he was so close to 110. Another telegram. That would have been a really, all I feel is regret. All I feel is the negative that he didn't make it to 110. But I was going to say on the royalty thing, my father founded a centre for Hebrew and Jewish studies in Oxford. And there was a fundraiser. And I was asked to be the after-dinner speaker. To introduce the after-dinner speaker. And I said, well, who's coming? You know, can I do any jokes about anyone? And they said, yes, Princess Anne's daughter's coming. And I went, oh, that's all right. Well, I can do stuff. What is it? Sarah Tindall? I can do jokes about her. So I turn up at this do and I said, where's Princess Anne's daughter? And they went, not Princess Anne's daughter, Prince Hassan's daughter.
Oh.
And that's a page of material out the window as you were sitting there thinking, oh, no. Because, you know, Prince Hassan of Jordan, his daughter was the guest of honour or whatever. And I'd done all the jokes, the wrong jokes. It's funny how you hear things you want to hear.
Yeah.
Listeners to take away. It's funny how you hear what you want to hear. Yeah.
Like people are listening to this podcast wanting to hear Elon Gold, but they're hearing Dan Patton. Presumably, if you'd have gone ahead with any material you might have had about Princess Anne instead of Prince Hassan, you would have had a bit of a Bruegus brewing. We know you said you don't really have much in the way of Bruegus going on in your life, but the big one I do want to know about, even if you're not going to share an actual Bruegus with us, we refer to it as the bagel beigel situation. So I'd like to know which camp you put yourself in. Are you bagel or are you beigel?
I'm so bagel. I can't even begin to think the beigel. It's just like I was in America when I was six because my father was teaching at Cornell University and it was obviously bagel until, you know, my in-laws, my wife's family and all said beigel. I thought they were just taking the piss. I had no idea that people actually said this. But now I'm completely open-minded about it. I'm really fine with whatever you want to say. I also like the Ashkenazi Sephardi thing because we always grew up, although I'm Ashkenazi, we had Sephardi pronunciation, which is modern Hebrew pronunciation rather than the sort of more shtetlized biblical Ashkenazi pronunciation. I always like the S's, you know, like talus. You know, we always said Shabbat Shalom. We didn't say good Shabbos. Mm. We said a talit, not a talus. So I always wondered if Paul Merton, the Ashkenazi for Paul Merton. But, you know, it's a tet and a taf, isn't it? It's a tet and a taf.
So Jews are all connected in all kinds of bizarre ways. Like we have loads of connections. We've talked about Limud Festival. Also, Philip and I are both connected to you, Dan, in that we've been Mock the Week stand-ins. So
you
for
have?
Listening,
well, I remember Philip more than I remember you, but it might have been Philip.
Well, I did it for about 7 years and lockdown kind of, I did it a little bit during lockdown, but we met long before that, Dan, at Aelith, because I was the youth worker at Aelith, and I was tasked with writing the Purim spiel one year.
Ah.
And we met for a drink because they wanted you to help me write it. And I think your advice was just go ahead and write it.
I think that probably would have been.
And it was like great. It freed me up beautifully. So,
by the way, you owe me for that. I've never billed, but now that we're doing this, I think it was because you were doing it later that I was much more involved in the rehearsals. Mm. And then sort of in the latter years, I wasn't. And by the way, in the rehearsals, there wasn't any of the real performers there.
Right.
It was just to make sure we had the photos and everything. So, you know, I'm not saying that the performers come in and rehearse it, because they didn't.
So we all have these weird and fascinating connections. But who is your most interesting Jewish connection?
I have two. One of them is my cousin called Simon Lovestone, Sir Simon Lovestone. Yeah, he's a sir. I'm not. What the hell? What am I, chopped liver? But he's a big psychiatrist, does all sorts of stuff about dementia and things. Very, very erudite, lovely guy. But I do, this is more tenuous, but I have a cousin called Hugh Feather.
That's also a great name.
So this is, it's my mum's sister was his mother, but the father was the first cousin of Brian Epstein. So I'm only once removed. So it's my cousin's cousin, or my cousin's dad's cousin was Brian Epstein's cousin. It got me no Beatles memorabilia at all because I was too young. But I always think that's pretty good. I once tried to say that to Paul McCartney as he was running away from me. I went to George Martin's funeral. Don't ask me how, but I did. And I'm a huge Beatles junkie. And I was talking to Wicks, who's part of Paul McCartney's band. And I was standing there, but I was wearing my Beatles tie, which I wear for various functions when I don't know how formal it's going to be, because it's always a good icebreaker. And it's got the four Beatles on it. And I saw Paul McCartney, this is right at the end when people are leaving, wending his way towards Wicks. And I'm going, I'm about to meet Paul McCartney. My life has been leading up to this. And he took one look at my tie and just walked off in the other direction. And I didn't even get to say hello to him. That's one of my big regrets.
We call this section 6 degrees of can't eat bacon. And I was trying to work out my cousin's cousin's father's cousin's cousin, Brian Epstein. I couldn't do the maths.
It's really not hard. It's my mother's sister's husband's cousin. My uncle by marriage, cousins.
Okay.
Here's a question for you, Rachel, because you're fairly orthodox. In Jewish law, is it permitted for a man to marry his widow's sister?
His widowed sister?
His widow's sister.
Oh, his widow's sister.
Yeah.
I don't.
What have you got planned?
Where does that come from?
Well, I'll tell you why. If you think it through, his widow's sister.
Yeah.
This means he's dead.
Oh, you were being clever.
See? So it was a little trick question there. I thought we could brighten the mood, bring our listeners in as a sort of, you know, something for everybody to do. And I thought it was a nice little moment, a moment that you might not have expected. Did you have all those things? They were called conundrums. It would be like a man pushes a car to a hotel and is bankrupt. You know, and then you could ask yes or no questions. So do you have that to cover endless coach journeys, or Cleopatra is dead on the floor in a pool of water and glass?
Yeah.
And then it turns out Cleopatra's a fish. Oh, a man gets an arm. No, gets an arm soup through the post and then tastes it and then shoots himself. Something like that. And whatever it is, it's. No, all right. This is what's known as a comedy cul-de-sac.
No, it's more that it's really triggering remembering those coach journeys.
A man pushes a car to a hotel and is bankrupt. Do you know what it is? I'll tell you.
Go on.
He's playing Monopoly.
I remember there were quite a few where the answer was something to do with ice. You know, like the person had been stabbed with an obstacle.
Well, that's the person who commits suicide.
Commits suicide and it's a pool of water.
Yeah.
So also, there was a snowman one.
So my kids currently love all these riddles, I think. So we're always being caught out with them. The ones, you know, you're driving a bus, you pick up 5 passengers, 10 passengers. You know that one?
Yes. Or a plane crashes on the border between England and Scotland. Where are the survivors buried?
Yes. Right. That.
Those.
I remember that one. Yeah.
What's the one here, Philip? I'm going to do this with you.
Okay.
Say roast 10 times fast.
Roast, 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 roast.
What do you put in a toaster?
Bread. I have a nine-year-old child who does all these. We say silk and we're not meant to say milk. You know, it's
This is what got us all into youth groups.
Well, I think this actually leads very nicely to the next question. You've already said that Whose Line Is It Anyway might have been inspired by your time at Hub and Im. So we do want to know how much, if at all, your career has been affected by your Jewishness.
Obviously, I think Habonim Draw was an influence, certainly in getting those sorts of things going. I mean, people exaggerate how much was taken from Habonim, but there's no doubt that I really got into creativity and comedy a lot through Habonim, not entirely. I also got a scholarship to America, and I was at Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then Northwestern. And Northwestern does this show called The Meow Show, which actually was improv. And that's the first time I'd ever got into improv. And that was influential too. That showed me how amazing improv could be. But the Jewishness, I think, it's more the people I knew. I did all my big shows with Mark Levison, and I met Mark in Habonim, and we've stayed great friends, and we've worked together all the way through, and he was very critical in getting all, you know, working on all these shows with me. So I think the Jewishness, I would say, comedy. My family loved comedy. My parents had great senses of humor. My parents were both in Habonim, and they met in Habonim, and a lot of their friends were very funny, and so I was surrounded by funny people when I was growing up. So I think it would be more that than anything absolutely direct. And also my anxiety. Part of the reason I think I'm not a bad producer is because I worry about everything. So I always assume, I always say, you're doing a show, assume everything will go wrong and cover yourself for that. And then if it doesn't, you're ahead of the game. Just people I know, you know, I'll say I'll meet you at somewhere. And I always give myself as a producer half an hour in case there's, you know, a traffic jam or the trains aren't running. And people turn up half an hour late because they always think everything will be perfect. So I think good producing is often because you're anxious and a bit, you know, bit of a worrier. That's probably where the Jewishness comes in.
I think someone was saying something very similar on last week's The Apprentice, You're Fired, where they were talking about to be a good manager of any kind of an event, which I suppose TV recordings, radio recordings, etc., they're still events. It's about being extra prepared and also ready to think on your feet, so you're immediately...
Definitely, but I think it's troubleshooting. It's looking ahead and go, okay, that should be fine, but if it isn't fine, what do we do? I remember dealing with an American agent. I was doing a show here and it required celebs, and the whole show was about this celeb, and we were flying them in, Serena Williams, actually. And the agent said, oh, we've just got to change of plan. She's now going to fly in and arrive on the day of the recording. And I went, oh, no, we can't do that, because if there's a problem, the whole recording is about her. You know, I can't do anything else. And they said, worst case scenario, she's a bit late. I went, no, that's not the worst case scenario. That's a not great, but not terrible. Worst case scenario is the plane gets cancelled and she doesn't come at all. That's the worst case scenario that you don't have to deal with, but I do. And I think, you know, slight pessimism, you need positiveness, you need positivity, I should say, to have maybe the desire and the drive and the hope and the thrill of doing something. But I think you need the worry and the negativity to think that things might go wrong, and therefore, what are you going to do with that?
Well, that's nearly all we've got time for, but how will our audience know what you're up to if you never call and you don't write? And normally we'd allocate 20 seconds to do this, but for you, 30.
What have I got? Well, the main thing, I've written a couple of plays which are doing the rounds at the moment, so I might be doing a read for one of those in the not too distant future. It's a farce. I think it's funny. At the moment, because there was quite a lot of development time, I've been doing writing of films and writing of plays. I did The Duck House 10 years ago with a guy called Colin Swash, and we did it in London, starring Ben Miller. And it ran for about 6 months at the Vaudeville Theatre. And that was incredibly exciting, because obviously something you haven't done as much is more exciting than something you do all the time. So I just absolutely love that. So I'd love to get a play on. I'm looking for investors. I don't know.
If you're listening, investors, do drop us a tweet.
That's right.
Well, you've come to the right place.
Yes. And then, I've got a lot of stuff going on in America. I'm trying to get stuff going on here. I think you should write to the BBC and say, bring back Mock the Week. That would be a good thing to do, because I would love Mock the Week to come back. I really feel it's still got legs. It's still got things to do. The great thing about Mock the Week was it was a great conduit for new stand-ups to come through. And stand-ups had the double whammy of COVID, which made their lives very difficult. And then Mock the Week, as I said, we were probably, us and Live at the Apollo, are the two main places you come through. And I think there are lots of great comedians coming through at the moment. There's more good news than you can deal with. And sorry, I I say good news, I mean news that's good for comedy. I don't mean any of the news is good. I would say it tends to be bad news, but it's a lot of stuff that's good for comedy. So, you know, I genuinely wish we were back on, because I think, you know, I loved working with that team. I love working with the people in our office. I love working with Dara and Hugh, Reese and Ed and Milton and all, and Angela and Maisie and all the incredible comedians we had. And I, as I said, there's new ones coming through. So that's something that I'd really wish would come back. And I am doing a lot of writing. And funnily enough, thinking of the jokes for tonight, I did think, oh, there would be stuff that I'd like to do with Jewish Church. Yeah.
You know, you're talking about wishing that Mock of the Week would come back. And just thinking about the advice that you get unsolicited from people who come and enjoy your comedy, where they just come up to us and say, but have you ever like just contacted Live at the Apollo and just told them you want to do it? I had that with you at Limud, that people kept saying, just go and talk to Dan, he'll put you on Mock the Week. And I was like, he knows who I am. I'm pretty sure that that's not how it works, that you don't go up to someone at a Jewish winter, you know, holiday camp and just have...
Well, also amazing. It's the reverse, because people always think that anybody will be available to do it. So they say, have you asked Dawn French? Have you asked Victoria Wood? It's like, yeah, obviously we've asked them, but I mean, they don't want to.
Victoria Wood, that would be a good.
And there was one time I went to this opening bit of Limud where lots of people were coming up and saying what they were going to do. And this American guy got up and said, I'm doing Whose Lines Anyway? I hear the producer, the creator of it's here. And I went, yeah, that's me. He just died in front of me. But there we go.
That's funny. But yeah, so maybe that's all you need to do, Dan. Just find someone to write to, and I'm sure they'll bring back Mock the Week.
That's it. All you need to do is write a letter. Write and a then letter. What could go wrong them. After
I think after that we should have the play out music would be the Jimmy Savile one letter is only the start of it.
Oh my god.
The time has just flown away.
I know. Oh, and it's like life, isn't it, Rachel? It's like life. You're enjoying it and then it's gone.
Lovely.
Well, I've absolutely loved this. I will now always think of Dan as the Jew who doesn't want to miss out on a countdown unless it's the top 100 songs about Little Red Sox.
Very sweet.
And as my grandfather used to say, I love seeing your smiling face arrive and I love seeing your little tuchus leave, which is a good thing as we've come to the end of this week's show.
As my grandmother used to say, if you haven't got anything nice to say, say it in Yiddish.
Oh, that reminds me, Dan, we haven't done Duolingo. So taking inspiration from your grandma, do you have any favourite Jewish or Yiddish expressions?
Well, we didn't grow up with much Yiddish in the family. We were much more Hebrew, but I love the word halashing. Halashing meaning you're salivating. It means you're just dying for some. You're halashing for some herring. You're halashing for some chicken. I don't know if it just applies to food or whether you're halashing to watch a good show, but I think it is just food. But to me, you know, as with a lot of Yiddish, it's so evocative with the sounds or whatever. But halashing, it sounds like you've got a mouthful of saliva, which, as we know, is a lovely image. That's what I do. That's a word that I love. You know, I love schlep. Broigus, I do think, is a great word. I think broigus is just... Oh, my friend Mark, by the way, and have on him. He thought the word seminar was a Hebrew word because we were always going off to seminars. And he thought that was Hebrew.
When I was in seminary, that's what made me think of it, we had an American teacher and he kept talking about a fillet of fish when he was talking about like kosher food. He kept mentioning a fillet of fish. And because in England, we don't say that, we say fillet. We all thought fillet must be like a Talmudic term. So we all wrote it in Hebrew, like fey yud, lamed yud, fillet. And we kept like trying to find out what it meant in Hebrew.
Well, you also know... This is quite biblical, but you know the thing you take, the statin. There's a statin I take, it's called atorvastatin, atorvastatin. Yeah. And I always think that sounds like biblical Hebrew. You know, tohu vavohu is like in Genesis, it means, you know, this sort of
chaos
in the universe, tohu vavohu. And I think atorvastatin sounds like that. Where do you get statins delivered? Who delivers your statins in New York? The Staten Island Ferry. I am here all. Who'd have thought we'd be talking about statins on this show?
I mean, that's very on brand.
Staten Island. It's a Jewish podcast. Yeah.
All that's left for us to do is to thank our guest, Dan Patterson. Follow him on social media.
Follow us on social media at Phillips Comedy.
At Rach Krieger.
At Jew Talking Without the G.
Don't forget to subscribe, like and share the show with everyone you know.
And join us next time on Jew Talking to Me. 2 Talking to Me was hosted by me, Philip Simon.
And me, Rachel Krieger.
It was produced by Russell Balkin and judged by our mothers.
Phil, are you Philip or Phil?
I'm Philip, but I won't be offended if called Phil. Okay. Were you ever a Daniel?
No, the only people who call me Daniel are people who knew me at primary school and doctors. I always know it's a thing, a fraud thing, when they say, hello, Daniel. And you're going, all right, what do you want?
Because I was always a Philip. And if my parents ever answered the phone at the house back in the days of the landline and anyone asked for a Phil, they were like, I'm sorry, there's no Phil here. We don't have a Phil.
Well, my school, my secondary school, we were all called by our surnames. Mm. And early on, you just didn't know anyone's first name. And I remember having to call up a friend and the mother answered. And I said, is Whittam there?
That's amazing.
Ridiculous thing. It was like, well, eventually we got to know each other well enough that we knew each other's names.
How did your school handle the multiple surnames? Because we had a family of four. They were all called Campbell surname. So it was Campbell 1, Campbell 2, Campbell 3 and Campbell 4. And when Campbell 1 left, number 2 didn't graduate. So at one point there was just a Campbell 4 in the school who had other...
But it would have been worse if somebody had been called Thunderbird.